Hello there. Today is Wednesday, July 31st, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, 10 of the 20 Democratic presidential candidates duke it out in their second debate.
Our biggest problem in Washington is corruption. It is giant corporations that have taken our government and that are holding it by the throat.
VOA is giving refugees a window to the outside world through the power of radio journalism. Also ahead, a jury finds an American pop singer guilty of copying the tune of another group's song. It's all on today's International Edition. Well, the second set of Democratic presidential debates may have been the last chance for some of the candidates looking to challenge President Trump in November of 2020. 10 of the 20 hopefuls faced off Tuesday night in Detroit, presenting their ideas to the American people. And joining us now, live here in studio, is VOA national correspondent Jim Malone. Jim, you watched it, you took notes. Who stood out to you, and who may have helped elevate their status a bit?
Well, we know that both Elizabeth Warren, the senator from Massachusetts, and Bernie Sanders, who ran in 2016, the senator from Vermont, were center stage in the 10 arrayed on stage. They took a lot of incoming fire throughout the night for being on the progressive side of the party on things like health care, the Green New Deal, environment. But they held their positions pretty strongly. And so actually, I think both Warren and Sanders are going to come out a little bit ahead in this. You had everybody else arrayed on the wings who was of varying degrees more moderate to somewhat conservative. And they were kind of firing questions at them on various topics. It really was, I think, the split in the Democratic Party on display between moderates and progressives. And what is the best way to defeat President Donald Trump? And a lot of the moderates are worried that if Democrats veer too far left, they will lose to Trump. And that's why they were challenging Warren and Sanders so strongly.
And of course, one of those big issues that there is a lot of debate over with between the moderates and the progressives is health care. And some rivals of Warren and Sanders argued that their proposals would take private insurance away from people who currently prefer their coverage or force a tax increase on the middle class. And John Delaney, not a well-known name, he's a former congressman who's been very critical of Medicare for All, had this exchange with Senator Warren.
Why do we got to be the party of taking something away from people?
No one is the party.
That's what they're running on. They're running on telling half the country that your health insurance is illegal. It says it right in the bill.
All right, thank
you. We don't have to do that. We can give everyone health care and allow people to have choice. That's the American way.
Look, thank you, Congressman. Senator Warren.
So look, let's be clear about this. We are the Democrats. We are not about trying to take away health care from anyone. That's what the Republicans are trying to do. And we should stop using Republican talking points in order to talk with each other about how to best provide that health care.
What'd you think of that?
Well, you could tell what the audience thought of it.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, in a Democratic primary, the progressive wing is a huge part of it. They're the activists. They're the ones who get out there. And that's why they've rallied to, back in 2016, Sanders. And now this year, somewhat, Elizabeth Warren is drawing them in. And she's a fighter.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what they want to hear. But again, from the moderate point of view, it's like, no, no, we need to win back some of these moderate voters that Hillary Clinton was not able to win 2.5 years ago if we have any chance of defeating Trump. This debate is going to go on. And of course, we know that one of the prime moderates in the race is Joe Biden, the current frontrunner.
Right. And I know he's proposed, you know, working with what we have, Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act, and improving on it. And no doubt he will have some strong words about Bernie Sanders, who also kind of came out swinging on the issue of health care.
500,000 Americans every year going bankrupt because of medical bills, 30,000 people dying while the health care industry makes tens of billions of dollars in profit. 5 minutes away from here, John, is a country. It's called Canada. They guarantee health care to every man, woman, and child as a human right. They spend half of what we spend And by the way, when you end up in a hospital in Canada, you come out with no bill at all. Healthcare is a human right.
Well, that was pretty strong. He was coming out fighting, too.
That's a distillation of Bernie Sanders. And mm-hmm. the fact is that the Sanders and, to some extent, Warren kind of factions are looking at, look, we need more of a revolution than just status quo. We need to change the whole fabric of the country. It's not just about Donald Trump. That worries Democrats, who are most concerned with defeating the president next year. So this divide we're seeing, this is going to play out all through the primaries. This is going to be, I think, the number one theme we're going to see it, be fought over. And that certainly was the case tonight.
And of course, we've had several shootings this week. Gun control is a big issue for Democrats. Republicans do not, they've got the line that Democrats want to take our guns away. Senator Amy Klobuchar had a pretty powerful moment there.
The people are with us now. After Parkland, those students just didn't march. They talked to their dads and their grandpas and the hunters in their family, and they said there must be a better way. Then we elected people in the House of Representatives, and guess what? It changed, and they passed universal background checks. And now that bill is sitting on Mitch McConnell's doorstep.
So she went after Republicans, not other Democrats on that one.
And Amy Klobuchar is one of these on the fringe Democrats who needs to make a move. She needed to have a strong debate. Not sure whether or not that'll be the judgment here. But the reason for this is the next debates won't come till September. Mm-hmm. And the qualifications are stricter. And we are likely not to see a number of these Democrats back on stage. So the stakes were really enormous tonight and tomorrow night for the lesser Democrats who are struggling to get known.
Right. I'm sure there will be a lot of them whittled down, I would say, after the next tomorrow night.
That's right.
And then, of course, we would be remiss if we didn't mention the fact that race came up quite a bit, given President Trump's recent string of racially charged tweets and comments. They really didn't hold back on that one either.
They didn't, although I must say I was a little what's happening in these Democratic debates, they're often focused on each other, on policy differences within the party. And that kind of distracts them from going after the president in a kind of more fulsome way. So, yes, there were comments by Senator Sanders and O'Rourke and others about the racial issues that the president has been involved in of late, but not as much maybe as I would have thought beforehand. So
they were so issue oriented.
They were, and because they're trying to sort themselves out, and we'll see it again on Wednesday night. The people are really struggling to get on there, and you have five or six Democrats led by Biden and Kamala Harris and a few others, Warren and Sanders, of course, who are kind of more at the top of the polls. Everybody else is just trying to keep a leg in the game.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, that is VOA national correspondent Jim Malone. Hopefully we'll be able to get your perspective again tomorrow night.
Sounds good.
When the other 10 candidates appear for the second night of debates. Thanks, Jim.
You bet.
Here are some of the stories we're following at voanews.com. And anti-Muslim hate crimes have dropped for the second year in a row. A nominee for the Pentagon's number two post is countering sexual assault allegations. California's governor signs a bill on presidential tax returns. And more than 12,000 children were killed or maimed in conflicts in 2018. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. The tens of thousands of Rohingya refugees living in camps in Bangladesh now have something to listen to on the radio. VOA Asia's Ira Melman talked about it with Amanda Bennett, the director of VOA.
We started a brand new 30-minute a day weekly program that's aimed at serving the Rohingya refugees who are in refugee camps based in Bangladesh. When I went to Bangladesh to visit the camps about a year ago, I realized with my team that there's almost no source of objective, truthful news and information that the Rohingya refugees can count on. So that's one of the reasons we decided to start it.
How do you zero in on these refugee camps technically? How does that work?
There's many different ways you can get transmissions and information into the refugee camps. What we're using is really old school right now. We're using shortwave, which is what VOA was traditionally, 50, 70 years ago, based on. It happens to work very well and has a very strong signal that can reach into the camps. And the refugees have access to radios that have been provided to them via various human rights groups, aid groups, so they can listen to the transmissions, and oftentimes they listen to them in groups.
What have they been listening to that you felt such a program was necessary?
When I was there, I observed groups of refugees listening to the types of broadcasts that were available, and they're very good, they're very useful, but they're very, very much public service kind of announcements. Here's how to tie your tarps down in the monsoon season. Don't let your kids play in muddy waters near the latrines. Be sure and get your shots. They were very, very practical, life-based things, and this is instead going to be international news and information, plus interviews with refugees and actual stories about their concerns and their lives.
And again, what is the overall goal of doing this?
Well, because there's no news and information available, it's the same goal that has driven Voice of America since our very beginning. Our very first broadcast was behind Nazi lines into Germany to give information to people who had no other way of getting it. So we want to make sure that these refugees have at least some access to news and information, because otherwise they don't know about whether they can trust the rumors that are spreading through the camp, or know whether or not recruiters are actually offering them jobs in the Philippines, or they really are sex traffickers. They don't have any really objective way to understand what's really going on.
So they're getting some fake news.
They're getting fake news, and they're getting it by word of mouth, basically, and through people who are spreading fake news.
Who is doing these programs for VOA?
So it's based in our Bangla service, because we need to transmit via Bangladesh, because that's where the refugees are. We've hired native Rohingya speakers, two of them here in Washington and two of them in the camps, to produce the shows in the Rohingya language. So every day it's produced by these four people under the supervision of the Bangla service. You know, this is something that VOA staffers have been particularly passionate about, because so many of the people who work for VOA are themselves refugees. So they have a very instinctive understanding of the refugee experience and how starved people in the camps are for information. So it's been a very, very great passion project for a lot of people here.
All right. That is VOA Director Amanda Bennett speaking with VOA's Ira Melman. A Myanmar government delegation did meet with representatives of hundreds of the thousands of the Rohingya Muslim refugees in Bangladesh this past weekend to talk about creating conditions for their safe repatriation. But the Reuters news agency says Rohingya refugees there in Bangladesh told the delegation they won't return to Myanmar unless they're recognized as an ethnic group in their home country. North Korea fired two short-range ballistic missiles off the East Coast Wednesday, its second weapons test in less than a week. North Korea is apparently angry over planned U.S.-South Korean military drills and trying to boost pressure on the U.S. to win concessions. Meanwhile, Iran's foreign minister called Tuesday on President Trump to reject his hawkish allies' thirst for war, adding that Iranians had outlasted every aggressor for millennia. The foreign minister has in the past said that so-called B-team, including Trump's national security advisor John Bolton, an ardent Iran hawk, and conservative Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, could goad Trump into a conflict with Iran. Germany's finance minister, meanwhile, says the country is working to prevent an escalation of tensions there, and said that it is coordinating closely with France and Britain to uphold the nuclear agreement. Joining us now to talk more about all of it is former U.S. ambassador to Azerbaijan, Richard Kalzlerich. He is now a distinguished visiting professor at the Shar School of Policy and Government at George Mason University. What do you make of all these ongoing escalations?
the rhetoric, getting pushed out from both sides, I don't think is helping us get to where we need to go, which is de-escalating the military confrontation that's going on. Mm-hmm. Quite frankly, I think the Iranians have missed an opportunity here to really put Trump in a very isolated position. The very public announcements that they're going to go against the agreement that they claimed they were going to stick with when Trump withdrew from the JCPOA earlier this year, and then the continued escalation with tit-for-tat, seizure of tankers, the drone shoot down and all, they've made it a lot easier for Trump to make this pitch, which the administration did for allies to step forward and help out in maintaining freedom of movement in the Strait of Hormuz.
So you think that basically that they had an opportunity to sort of garner some sympathy because
yes.
they were complying with the JCPOA?
Right, right.
And that if they had continued, that the allies would have really had sort of an argument to make?
Sure. You know, I just think that the steps that they've taken to be confrontational in a military sense in the Gulf has just reinforced that movement away, if you will, from an opportunity to use a stronger position to one where they're basically playing a weak hand.
But we heard this week that the Europeans are really committed to trying to stay in that agreement. They just made a statement about that Monday. Is that still possible without the United States?
I think it would be very hard to hold that agreement together without the U.S. And I have to say without Iran, too. I mean, Iran has said it's going forward with its enrichment activities, which, you know, put it, if not already, very soon in violation of the agreement.
Do you think that was a strategy from this administration who sort of had their eye on Iran from the beginning?
I'm very critical of the administration's foreign policy in a whole lot of areas. But I think this is a good example of, as with North Korea, Trump wants to control all the cards here. And whatever, you know, his Secretary of State or National Security Advisor says, he's going to have the last word. And it may be a word that's quite different than what the traditional official spokespeople for foreign administration and foreign policy say. I would not be surprised. I mean, look what happened with North Korea. I would not be surprised if Trump really believes that if he just sat down with Iranian leaders that they could do a deal.
We've just heard the North Korean officials say that they're working on more talks to revive the denuclearization negotiations with North Korea. It seems like he wants a deal with North Korea, but I wonder, because of the issue with the U.S. being such a staunch ally of Israel,
mm-hmm.
if that is part of what is sort of preventing this administration from giving Iran a chance to comply.
What I just find hard to sort of work my thinking through, if the administration was approaching this rationally, is why do you give up this agreement with Iran, which clearly was under international supervision and obligations to observe, you know, no enrichment activities for a specified period of time. Basically, he walked away from that. In North Korea, it seems like they're moving to a position of saying, we'll accept a deal with North Korea that kind of looks like what we had with Iran, but we walked away from. I don't get it. You're in a situation now where you have no agreement with either party. But if he's so anxious to resume negotiations with the North Koreans aren't going to give up their nuclear program. And would he allow the North Koreans to have a less of a set of constraints on their nuclear program than Iran?
How concerned are you that we could stumble into a war in the Middle East?
Well, there's always that chance of, you know, more direct force-on-force confrontation. You know, I don't think this president wants another war. So being on a road to war with Iran, whatever the Israelis would like us to do, you know, at this point, I don't sense it. But there could be, you know, inadvertent contact between our military forces. We've got so many ships in the region, plus ground forces and air forces. This is where you can get an escalation of the military conflict. I think the real risk is inadvertent contact between our military forces, which would escalate beyond what is already a very tense situation.
That's former U.S. Ambassador to Azerbaijan, Richard Kauslerich. He is now a distinguished visiting professor at the Schar School of Policy and Government at George Mason University. Immigration rights advocates are accusing the Trump administration of still separating hundreds of children from their families, despite a judge's order against that. AP correspondent Jackie Quinn reports.
More than 900 children have been separated from their families since last June, with about two-thirds of the cases being for alleged criminal conduct. But according to the American Civil Liberties Union, six of the cases involved marijuana possession, eight were for forgery or fraud, and one case involved property damage of just $5. In June of 2018, a federal judge in California ordered that the government stop splitting up families, except in extreme cases like a child's safety at risk. The Justice Department had no immediate comment, but an ACLU attorney filing a 200-page report says it's shocking the Trump administration is still separating families. I'm Jackie Quinn.
And you're listening to International Edition on VOA.
Need a little straight talk? Want to make sense of the world around you? Ask a question. Hear what others have to say? If so, Voice of America has a variety of talk shows for you. Lifestyle, health, politics, youth, sports. We have it all. Tune into our discussion shows on the radio, TV, or the internet. They examine a wide variety of issues and world events not always covered by other media. VOA.
Voices. We're talking about the news and issues you're talking about.
Sharing stories of development and growth across Africa, around the world, and in our lives. Topics that inform, empower,
and change the rules.
It's time for Our Voices with me, Haiti Adams Fitzpatrick.
And Hadiza Kiari.
And Ayan Bior.
And Orion Itangi Shaka.
Join us on Facebook at VOA Our Voices.
It's time for Our Voices.
VOA's International Edition continues. Well, there has been a lot of talk lately in the United States about the need for criminal justice reform, and those efforts have made headway with the release of thousands of incarcerated individuals from federal prisons across the country under what is called the First Step Act. The bipartisan organization Cut 50 led the fight to pass the First Step Act, which is the most significant criminal justice reform law in over a decade in the U.S. Joining us to talk more about the efforts to make this happen and support people in their success after being released is Cut 50 co-founder and national director Jessica Jackson. Tell us why such a big problem. What is the problem with our justice system and prisons?
The United States only holds about 5% of the world's population, but it holds 25% of the world's incarcerated population. We, since the 1980s, have been increasing our tough-on-crime laws. And what we didn't realize is that even though we were getting people off the streets, we were actually not doing anything to address public safety needs because we were neglecting to address the underlying reason why people are committing crimes. So while we might have been incarcerating more people, our communities were actually becoming less safe, and we were spending a lot of resources, hundreds of billions of dollars a year, incarcerating people. Both parties, people on both sides of the aisle, have come together over the last decade and started to say, look, let's not take this tough-on-crime approach. Let's take a smart-on-crime approach and actually use our resources to address mental health issues, to address substance abuse issues, to address economic crimes, and get people back on their feet and contributing to society as opposed to just throwing them in cages and leaving them there.
My understanding is a lot of the people that are incarcerated and have been incarcerated for long periods of time are really stuck there for committing low-level crimes.
People are there for low-level crimes, but I would say that even the people who aren't there for low-level crimes, the system is failing. We're failing to invest in people and get them the resources they need to succeed. And instead, when people are coming out of prison, they're given very few options to succeed, and it's a huge hurdle to get their lives on track.
What is First Step? What is the goal?
The First Step Act is a bill that addresses both prison and sentencing reform, and its primary goal is to get people job ready and inject some fairness into the criminal justice system. Now, it's just the first step, but it was a pretty monumental step. In fact, almost 5,000 people have come home from prison today, many of whom are much better prepared to succeed than they otherwise would have been. And we're really refocusing our prisons towards being a place of rehabilitation instead of just a punitive system, so that when people come home, they can be ready to jump right into jobs job, to find housing, to reconnect with family, and to contribute to society. This began really in the last decade when folks on both sides of the aisle said, this is crazy, we're spending so much money, and we're getting terrible outcomes because most of the people who are coming home are ending right back up inside. If this was a stock market, you would never invest in a stock that was failing 60, 70, 80% of the time, right? Mm-hmm. Why would we invest in a system that's failing at those incredible rates? And so you've seen leaders on both sides of the aisle with coming together over the last decade trying to get legislation done. But last year, we were actually able to get it done. I was fortunate to stand there when President Trump signed it into law on December 21st.
Jessica, I know that women are the fastest growing population of people incarcerated in the United States, and many of them have backgrounds of trauma that led to more trauma that led them to commit crimes or were involved with people that are committing crimes. My understanding is that this act also addresses women.
Yes, absolutely. Like you said, the women's population has grown exponentially. In fact, in federal prison, it's increased by about 700% over the last three decades. But the truth is, prisons just weren't built with women in mind. So the First Step Act has a few provisions that begin to address this. For example, it bans the shackling of women who are pregnant and in labor, and even for the first 12 weeks postpartum after they've had their baby. It also requires that institutions give hygiene items, sanitary napkins, to women who are inside of the prison to give them back a little bit of dignity. Now, there's still a lot more that needs to be done, but these provisions, plus the ability to be closer to your family and your children, are a good start for the women in prison.
What needs to be done to ensure that people that have been incarcerated are able to be successful after their release?
That's a very important question, and I think some of the changes start, with shifting the focus of the system and the day you are sentenced to prison, being able to start preparing for your release, which will be coming. So that's programming inside of the prison, that's help for substance abuse disorders, that's being able to access the outside world, attend job fairs, meet with potential employers. But a lot of it is also on the government. We need to really look at the current housing market, make sure there are places for people to live when they're coming home. And then, of course, we need the private sector to step up. We need private employers to step up and say, look, we all make bad decisions from time to time, but nobody should be judged by their worst decision. And we're willing to hire people from a second chance workforce, give them a job so that they can actually contribute to society. And I think we're starting to see all three of these things come into play right now because of the First Step Act and because we had such a wide and diverse coalition of supporters for the First Step Act.
All right, Jessica Jackson, co-founder and national director of the bipartisan organization Cut 50. Thanks for being with us. Well, a jury has found that Katy Perry's 2013 hit Dark Horse copied a 2009 Christian rap song. The 9-member federal jury in Los Angeles returned the unanimous verdict on Monday. The decision came 5 years after Marcus Gray and two co-authors first sued, alleging that Dark Horse stole from the song Joyful Noise, one that he released under the stage name Flame. Gray's attorneys argued that the beat and instrumental line featured through nearly half of Dark Horse are substantially similar to those of Joyful Noise. Perry and the song's co-authors testified during the 7-day trial that none of them had heard the song or heard of Gray before the lawsuit. Dark Horse spent 4 weeks at number one on the Billboard charts and earned Perry a Grammy nomination. The case now goes to a penalty phase where the jury will decide how much the plaintiffs are owed for the copyright infringement. You've been listening to International Edition. That does it for today's show, but you can find us anytime at voanews.com. Thanks so much for joining us, and thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Greg Burns. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have yourself a wonderful day.
you know what you're falling for? Baby, do you dare to do this? 'Cause I'm coming at you like a dark horse. Are you ready for, ready for a perfect storm, perfect storm? 'Cause what's your mind, what's your mind?
This is